Welcome to another edition of Big Blue Kickoff Live right here on Giants.com. John Schmelk, Paul Dottino, the phone number for you, 201-939-4513. We'll take your calls a little bit later on in the show after our guest. The NFL Combine wrapped up in Indianapolis yesterday. Paul and I were out there. I'm sure if you haven't seen the shows, you should go back and watch them and listen to them. A lot of good scout-based reports and information on all these prospects that will be available in the 2018 NFL Draft, but we really didn't dig deep into the numbers too much from an analytical perspective, and that's what we're going to try to do a little bit today with Ken Platy, who has developed the relative athletic score metric, which kind of puts together measurements and test results to see where players stand up to each other athletically, and he joins us now. He's at MathBomb on Twitter. Ken, you got John Schmelk and Paul Dottino here in New Jersey. How are you today?
Great, man. I'm glad to be on.
Hi.
Hey, thanks for having us. And let's start with methodology first, Ken, before we start diving into players. How do you come up with these scores? It seems to be on a scale of 0 to 10. Is it different for each position group? How do you, stress different tests over the other measurements? How does it all come together to come up with these composite athletic scores?
Sure. The idea was to create a metric that would show what player measurements actually mean in context of their position. So if you have a guy that runs a 4.53 in the 40, that's a varying levels of good based on what position you're looking at, right? That's okay for a wide receiver. That's pretty good for a running back. That'd be great for a defensive end. But you don't really get that context without knowing more about the positions and what the measurements mean. So it takes those metrics and it puts them on that like you said, a scale of 0 to 10 compared to their position group all the way back to 1987. It includes combine and pro day metrics if they're available. So we supplement with pro day data if they don't have anything from the combine. But once we do all that, we do that for the height, weight, all the measurements that go on at the combine. We composite an average based on that, and then the average is also put on a 0 to 10 scale compared to the position group, and that's where we get our final score from.
Historically, Ken, how much do these athletic scores correlate with performance? Is it more once you get below a certain number, that's when your chance of success is very poor? How does it correlate the raw data to what you eventually see from these guys on the field?
Yeah, it's more the extremes. I mean, once you fall below that 5.0 mark, you have a very low hit rate for your positions, almost every position, actually.
Okay.
But the higher up you go, we benchmark it at 8.0. It's, like I said, 0 to 10, so an 8 out of 10 is considered an elite range. And you have about half of your Pro Bowlers in that range, in that above 8 range. And not just Pro Bowlers, but 750 to 1,000-yard rushers are fall in that range. Same thing for receivers. About half of those, if not more, fall in that 8.0 or above range. So it's both. You don't really want a guy to be below a certain level, and you really prefer a guy to be above a certain level.
I think it's almost more important that you find out the bust rate than you find out how many guys are elite or who are good.
It can be. It's very important to know that kind of stuff. And I know from a draft standpoint, there's only been one running back that's been drafted in the first round since 1987 that had a score below 5, and that was Mark Ingram. You don't have players that get drafted if they have poor metrics.
Interesting. All right, so let's start digging into this year and even recent years, if you want to get into it. Who are some of the guys that came in that got that under 5 score that were supposed to be very good players heading into the combine, and then we saw them either fall or still get selected high and then really struggled and failed on the pro level?
Yeah, the most recent one was Laquon Treadwell got drafted in the first round by the Minnesota Vikings. He had a very poor score. He didn't measure well at all coming out of the combine, and he struggled when he came into the pros. There are instances of guys that have measured poorly that have still done well. You always want to go back to the tape. You never want to rely just on the numbers.
Of course.
But it helps to supplement them, right? You have a guy that looks fast on tape, and then he measures fast. Well, okay, you just checked your box. You don't mark it twice. But if a guy comes in and he looks fast and then he measures poorly, like we saw with Laquon Treadwell, then maybe you have to start weighing that a little bit and start looking at whether what he does on tape wins enough, and you think that projects well enough to the NFL to be able to say, okay, I'm going to take him anyway despite the numbers.
You mentioned earlier you're taking combine numbers plus pro day numbers. So do you take the guy's best numbers from his workout? In other words, if he does great at his pro day but didn't do so well at the combine, are you taking his best numbers and throwing out his bad ones, or are you averaging all of his numbers together when you come up with a final grade on the guy?
We actually take the combine data if they have it, and then we use pro day if they don't. So if a guy doesn't run his cone, for instance, and then he does it at his pro day, we'll use that. But if he runs a good 40 or a bad 40 at his combine and then a great 40 at his pro day, we just keep the combine number. The context is there, though. If you, this is all in an application that you can download, and you can remove numbers and move numbers around, do what-if scenarios or whatever to see what they are. So if you wanted to see what his numbers looked like without those combine numbers, like just taking the best one, then you could just delete the combine ones, hit a button, and it'll show you what those numbers would look like.
Okay.
And Ken, if people wanted to download the app to do this, where could they do that?
The download is at relativeathleticscores.com. There's a link on the landing page to download the application from there. It's currently only on Windows. It's in beta testing right now. It'll be up in the Windows market sometime, hopefully soon. I'm trying to get it done as fast as I can, but you know, with the combine and everything already going on, it's a little tough to do both.
Yeah, absolutely. And I don't think anybody was surprised, Kent, when you sent me some of the composite scores for the running backs, and Saquon Barkley came within 0.04 of a point of a perfect 10 score on your chart. Obviously, testing off the charts here at the combine. Historically, how many running backs have gotten into the range Barkley came in that 9.96 area?
Yeah, it's a pretty high tier to be in, right? You have a guy right now. His score is fifth all time out of 1,053 running backs that I have in my database. So that's really, really good. he's behind James Stewart, who was drafted in the first round
good
by
player.
The Jaguars, I believe. And Edgerrin James is right above him. So that's
really
that's not
good
bad.
Player.
That's not bad company to be keeping right now.
No, not at all.
So there's plenty of guys in there that fall in that range now. That's current range. But if you're looking back in time, I mean, there's a very long list of guys that have done well in the NFL that have measured in that range. You know, the Adrian Peterson measured in the 9 range. David Johnson measured at 9.86. So Saquon Barkley actually measured better than David Johnson did. You have a lot of guys that measured in that range that have done very well.
Now, Ken, as with many analytics services, no matter what it is that they're measuring, over the course of time, as numbers have become more and more popular, you have some teams that are starting to use these as consulting devices. I mean, even Pro Football Focus has a lot of NFL teams that use part of their data. Maybe not all of it, but part of it. At this point, is your data being used at all? And you don't have to name names and give anybody up if you can't. But is your data being used by anybody in the league?
I know it's being used by agents. I talk to agents quite a bit. I use a lot of different sources to pull in this information. You know, not all the pro day information is available right off the bat, and it doesn't all get posted to the various websites. You kind of got to put your feelers out there and try to find out where you can get that information from, be it from the schools themselves or from the agents. But I get contacted by agents quite a bit asking about their guys and what they're measuring at and say, hey, what do you think this is going to look like if this is what he's doing in training?
You better not tell him.
I haven't been contacted by any teams yet, but I know that there are a couple that have actually looked at my data.
Yeah, but if you tell them the score is a 5, they're hanging up and saying, no, we don't need that data. It's okay. That's not going to help our. That's not going to help our money. That's not going to help our price.
You know, it's funny, and
hey,
you know,
if you know where you're doing poorly, you can say you got a hamstring, right, and not do that one.
Yeah, there you go. Hey.
Yeah, and it's funny, you know, one of those guys at the combine that I think people expected to test well, and we never got a really chance to see, was Ronald Jones, and he's part of kind of that second tier of running backs. And boy, looking at some of these scores, this is not a one running back class here. Sony Michel, no. Royce Freeman, Nick Chubb, we had some very good scores from that second group of running backs, didn't we, Ken?
Oh, absolutely. This was an extremely athletic running back class, and it's hard to stress just how much that is in context, right? Because you always hear about how athletic guys are around the combine, because that's what the combine's for, is to talk about how athletic these guys are. Yeah, but we had, let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. We had 8 different running backs come in the elite range in the combine, and that's nuts. You don't usually get more than maybe 3 or 4. We got 8 of them this year.
Wow.
So that's craziness. And I would be pretty. I think it's a pretty safe bet that Ronald Jones probably would have landed in that range too if he hadn't have pulled up.
Mm-hmm. One thing give me a little bit, if you can, a little bit of a better understanding of how you're able to translate. For example, I'm looking at Nick Chubb, right? And I see he's listed at 5'11", I guess, right? It says 5'1".
Yep.
07, and then it says score is 572. I know you probably have a proprietary mathematical formula, but if you could give me the philosophy behind, how does the score equate to the actual physical measurement?
So for the two physical measurements, for height and weight, it's just a ranking system, so it's bigger is better. So if he were to come in at 280 pounds, that's probably not ideal for a running back, right? But
yeah,
that would still show up as a very high score on here, probably a 10. I don't think we've ever had a 280-pound running back. but what that helps to do is it helps to weight out the other scores, right? Because if you run a 4.52 like Nick Chubb did at 227 pounds, that's really good, right?
Right.
But if you ran a 4.52 and you weighed like 185 pounds, that probably wouldn't mean as much, right?
Okay.
But it helps to balance out the scores by having some size metrics in there just to add a little bit into it.
All right,
they're all weighted equally. All 10 of those scores are weighted equally. So the size counts for about 20% of the average.
Let me make sure like I'm getting this right now. So he gets for his 40 time a 4.52, he gets a 7.5 score for that. That's his credit for that 40 time. Now you're telling me if a running back ran 4.52, his score is going to be what compared to 7.50?
It'll be 7.50.
It would still be 7.50.
It doesn't get compared to the weight. The weight is included in the score so that we don't have to do any complex calculations into
okay.
it. Any running back runs a 4.52, it's going to have the same score.
Got it. I got you.
Got it. In terms of the drills themselves, do you favor any specific drills for specific positions? Like, do you find the three cone to be more important? A lot of people think that's essential for a defensive end, guys that have to change direction, slot corners, or do you measure all these drills identically based on the position group?
So for the scores themselves, we measure all the drills identically. There's no weighting or anything like that involved with creating the scores. But when you're actually looking into the data and you're trying to do some scouting and look into the numbers a little bit deeper, you absolutely look at different things differently, right? So you already mentioned the three cone for pass rushers, a very good indicator of success if a pass rusher runs a three cone under seven. I know Derek Barnett last year, he didn't measure out all that well at the combine in all of his metrics except the three cone where he did really well, which is why he was still a first-round pick. But if you're looking at like running backs and corners and wide receivers, it kind of depends on what type of player that is. Like a power back isn't going to have the same requirements as, say, a scat back, right? You're going to want your power back to be more explosive. You're going to be looking at those vert and broad scores a little bit better than you would if you're looking at a scat back, who's probably going to pay more attention to like the shuttle or the cone. Your speed's going to mean a little bit more.
All right, I'm going to ask you the magical question because this is all new to me. I had not heard of your service prior to John mentioning it to me this morning. So I'm playing dumb here because I really am dumb. I had not heard of what you guys were doing prior. So let me ask you this. We talked a lot at the Combine about how certain positions get shied away from at the top of the draft. For example, all this talk about Quentin Nelson. And he's a guard. And how can you take a guard, you know, in the top five picks or certainly number two with the Giants? Because historically, that's not the way you go at that position. There's also the talk about the durability with the running backs. Maybe they don't have a long shelf life. So how can you take a running back there when some people say a quarterback could be at the helm for 12 years? A running back may only last five or six. Do your calculations at all show any relevance to the value of certain positions given what the historical perception is for certain positions being more valuable than others?
So you're looking more at what players and how successful they are once they get into the NFL, right? So once you start looking into how much success they have when they get into the NFL, you try to figure out how much value that is for your team.
Right.
My metrics are all entirely about athletics, so I'd be more looking at how athletic a guy has to be for you to consider them valuable based on the success rate.
Okay.
On that.
Okay.
For offensive tackles, you want to have those elite athletes, and it gets a little bit less the further towards the interior you get. But like you said before, you want to hit a certain floor at least, right? So if you come in and you have a guard that measures poorly coming out of the combine, maybe they're considered a first-round pick, that's a much bigger risk than just taking a guard in the first round. If you're taking a guard who measured poorly, that's a much higher risk than just taking a guard in the first. Mm-hmm. Quentin Nelson's measured out very well so far, but we look back, at like Chance Warmack, who was considered one of the best guard prospects to come out since whenever when he was drafted. He measured really poorly, though, and he ended up busting out when he came into the pros. Well, he's not out of the NFL yet, but he hasn't done well at all. But that's where you start to measure the risk using metrics like this, is saying, okay, do I want to take a guard in the first? Maybe I do. Maybe I consider that. Well, then you see how he measures out, and if he measures out poorly, you go, you know, I'm already not thinking about a guard. He measured poorly. Maybe I scratch that one off.
Right,
if he comes in and he measures out like an elite athlete, and you're already thinking that a guard would be valuable enough for you to take that pick, if he measures out like an elite athlete, you know that your hit rate's going to be higher. Mm-hmm. That's a little bit better risk for you to take.
Okay. So let's get down to the brass tacks then. We're joined by Ken Platy. He does Road of Athletic Scores at MathBomb on Twitter. Ken, who are some of the guys, based on their testing this week, that were considered high draft picks, first-round picks, that you have put big red flags, buyer beware on, after what you saw from their testing? And feel free to list as many guys as you want, offense, defense, just give me any number that you think are like, boy, I'd be really careful with these guys based on what they scored.
Yeah, well, the big one is going to be Orlando Brown out of Oklahoma. He came
Shocker.
In as one of the top offensive tackle prospects, and you couldn't bomb the combine any harder than he did. I think he had the worst 40-time shuttle, vert, and broad of any player ever at the combine. So he did about as horrible as you could. He only had one score that was average, and it was only average. It wasn't even, like, way above average, just at average. Everything else was terrible. So he pretty much tanked his draft stock from a potential first-round pick. He could even go undrafted now. He's really big, so he'll probably still get picked up by somebody late. But I would never take somebody with that kind of measurables in the first round or second round or third round. So that's millions of dollars that he just left on the table right there. Who is the running back? Marcus Walton, the running back from
Miami,
was another guy that I think left a lot of money on the table. Yeah, he was injured last year, so he didn't get a lot of play, but some mm-hmm. people were talking about him as a day two pick. But he didn't really measure well at all. He ended up with a 3.27 RAS, so that's below five. That's below that mark where you want to start thinking about it. But he's small. He came in at just over 5'9 and 202, so he's small for a running back. And then he ran a 4.6 in the 40, which is just not that good. So if you're already coming in small and not measuring out well for your speed or anything, what value are you going to bring to a team? You know, they're going to go back to your tape and they're going to say, well, are you really that fast? Can you really outrun defenders? So those are the guys I think that had the worst days out of anybody. I know there's going to be a lot of talk about Calvin Ridley, the wide receiver.
That was my question.
Over the next couple of months.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's going to be a lot of talk about him because he did really poor in his spark metric, which is a different composite score that I don't do. But I think he measured out in like 7th percentile for that, which is no good. 7th percentile on anything is terrible. For Raz, he ended up under 5. And as I said before, you don't really want to – you want to really weigh that risk when you're drafting somebody that high in the first round. And the last couple of guys, the wide receivers anyway, that were drafted in the first that were under 5 were Kelvin Benjamin, who didn't outlive his first contract and ended up getting traded. Mm-hmm. And then Laquon Treadwell, who's been doing really badly in the pros. So Calvin Ridley's the guy that you're going to hear talked about, I think, the most, even though his score was only right about average. And it wasn't terrible, but it was still right about average. So he's a guy, I think, that hurt his stock a lot.
I'm going to ask one more question on the offense, and I'm sure Paul has some defensive questions he wants to ask about that side of the ball, because you didn't mention any guys on defense. Of the wide receiver group, we're told this isn't a top-heavy group, but it's deep. How does this class, from an athletic standpoint, can compare to wide receiver classes of recent history?
From an athletic standpoint, this is a very athletic draft class for wide receivers. I agree with you about it not being a very top-heavy class. I think from a tape standpoint, you're going to run into a lot of question marks. But from just a pure athletic standpoint, we've got quite a few really good athletes coming out of this class. DJ Chark ended up with a 9.91 RAS.
Wow.
Which, again, that's out of 10. That's craziness. But I think he ran like a 4.34 in the 40. It was nuts. The fantastically named Equanimeous St. Brown came out with a 9.84 out of 10. So that's really good for him. I know some had questioned whether he had enough athleticism. He was considered a freak athlete back when he came out of high school, but that talk died down a little bit as he had his career at Notre Dame. Cortland Sutton's one of the top wide receivers in this class, and I think he, more than anybody, gains value from Calvin Ridley not doing as well, because Cortland Sutton was that other guy that people thought very highly of. But he measured really well. And then Alan Lazard from Iowa State, most people were thinking that he was going to come in and run a 4.7 in the 40. Nobody was coming in thinking that this guy was going to measure well at all. And they definitely weren't thinking that he was going to come out as an elite athlete. This guy was considered by some draft analysts to be one of the worst athletes, just pure athletic standpoint, coming into this combine. He walks out with a 9.26 RAS out of 10. And he measured above average or elite in every single category except for the agility drills, which he didn't do. So it, more than anybody in the draft, he did a really, really good job at the combine.
I got to ask you about linebackers because everybody knows the Giants not only need linebackers, but they need athletic linebackers, of which that's what your specialty is with this mathematical computation. So how many really sharp, top-of-the-line athletic linebackers do you think there are in this draft?
Oh, boy, if you need an athletic linebacker, you hit you picked a good time to need one, I'll tell you that much.
How about that?
We actually ended up the highest score that you can get for Raz is a 10, a 10 out of 10, right? And there's only going to be one guy ever that holds a 10 at any given time. And if somebody else comes in and tears up the combine and does really good, they're going to knock that guy out of that spot, and he's going to take over that spot.
I hate to tell you, Lawrence Taylor would have been 11.
Yeah.
Lawrence Taylor would have been 11.
Right.
Okay? I'm just letting you know.
Right. So there is one guy that came into this combine and walked out with a 10.0 score, and it's a linebacker. So Georgia's Lorenzo Carter walks out of the combine with a perfect 10 score for Raz right now. He did most of the metrics there. I think he skipped the shuttle and the cone, and he didn't do his bench. So his score could still come back down if he doesn't do really well in those. But he scored an 8 or higher in every single metric and a 9 or higher in all but one. So he walked out of the combine with a perfect score. If you need an athletic guy, that's a good way to start. Leighton Van Der Esch came into the combine, and he was getting all kinds of Brian Urlacher comps. And it's like, Brian Urlacher was one of the most athletic linebackers to ever come out of college football. Mm-hmm. He played at an all-pro level for years. He's a first ballot Hall of Famer. No pressure, Leighton Van Der Esch, to do well at the combine. But I was joking. I was calling him Leighton Van Der Locker when I was talking him up at the combine. And he ended up measuring out really well. He ended up with a 9.87 out of 10. Which is obviously very, very good. It's a top 20 score out of almost 1,500 linebackers that I have in the database. But when I first ran it before the code, because there's it's a relative metric, the more data you add, it changes the scores around a little bit. They shuffle a couple of points. When I first ran it, it was a 9.92, which is what Urlacher is at right now. And I was like, oh, maybe those comps were a little bit warranted. I guess joking about it maybe pushed it in the right direction. Okay. You also have Malik Jefferson out of Texas, who had a 9.86. Tremaine Edmonds, a guy that's getting hyped up from Virginia Tech. He's only 19 years old. He'll be 20 when he's drafted. Second youngest player coming out of college football ever.
Yep.
And Tremaine Edmonds had a 9.84. I know he's missing a couple metrics yet, so that could go up or down. And then there's a couple of sleepers, guys that weren't really getting talked up that much. Matthew Thomas from Florida State ended up with a 9.74 out of 10, and Oren Burks from Vanderbilt ended up with a 9.62. Fred Warner's another guy that I think you're going to hear talked about
BYU.
In that early day two consideration from Brigham Young, and he had a 9.36. So, I mean, I've mentioned, what, six or seven guys already, and we haven't even gotten out of the nine.
Yeah, and usually your nines are first-rounders, right? So that also tells me there's got to be a bunch of second- and maybe third-rounders that the Giants could still be interested in who might be in, what, seven or eight on your scale?
Yeah, and you're gonna find these guys because this is purely an athletic metric. So some of these guys are gonna be fantastic athletes, but maybe their tape isn't as good. Lorenzo Carter had that perfect 10 score, and that may push him into the first round just because he's so athletic. But his tape, you know, he didn't really have as much production as you'd want out of somebody that athletic. We mentioned the running backs earlier. Kalen Ballage was another guy that had just a really great athletic score, but he didn't have that production to match. So those guys aren't really going to go as high as their athletic measurements are saying they should, just because their tape maybe isn't as good.
Yeah.
So you might be getting a guy with a 9 or an 8 in that second or third round just because their tape, you know, they're a little bit more raw. They need a little bit more work. So you might still end up getting one of those guys.
Ken, final question from me. How much do you think these numbers, and whether it's your measurements or the Spark ratings or just however teams, you know, take these numbers and height weight into consideration. You've been doing this a while. Do you see now players moving more because of what they do at the combine than before? Is it less? Has it not changed much? Are people taking the metrics more seriously? What's your feel in terms of what direction this is going with tape, combine, and metrics all kind of put together into one?
Yeah, and it's very clearly moved towards the direction of this stuff mattering more. And I think what's helped a lot, more than anything, is just the NFL really hyping up the combine and making this an event, making this a whole thing for these players because they're preparing more, right? Guys are spending a month and a half, 2 months preparing just for this event, and you can see it when the guys go out to run the 40. You know, they don't just go up there, put their hand in the dirt, and run. You know, they get themselves set, they set their feet, they get themselves situated, they put their hands in the right spot, they move their body back so they can spring out and get the best time. So you're seeing a lot more people trending towards the athletic stuff because the guys are preparing for it more. You always get guys that get overhyped for athleticism, your Mike Mamulas and Vernon Golston and guys like that get overhyped and then they bust out and then you get that overcorrection from people saying, oh, well, these workout warriors, we don't really care for them. But a lot of these guys that are measuring really well, they have great tape too. And part of why they're measuring as well as they are isn't just that they're great athletes, it's that they're preparing well for this athletic testing. So I think you're going to continue to see it trend that way, and more so for some positions than others. I know tight end is one of the positions where it's just insane how athletic these tight ends are. We didn't really talk about it. Mike Gesicki had one of the highest scores ever for a tight end. I think it was third highest all time for the Three Sigma athletes. And my stuff, I think, is also third highest for Raz. So he was just a fantastic athlete. And you're seeing a lot more of that, just those great athletes coming out of college that are bigger, stronger, faster, more agile than you've ever seen before.
Ken, I know I said last question, I lied. How many exceptions to the rule are there? Like, if you go back, how many guys are there where, you know, you had them in an under five, let's say, in your metric, yet they still come into the pros and end up doing well? And have you been able to figure out what the difference is for those guys, why they're able to succeed without having the great raw athletic ability that you measure?
Oh, yeah. You know, I mean, whenever you run anything with metrics, you're going to find out who those outliers are because people will tell you. That's the first thing that you get is the combine doesn't matter because Antonio Brown didn't do well at the combine, and that's totally true, but Antonio Brown was also a sixth-round pick. You know, and Antonio Brown didn't come out of nowhere and oh my God, the Steelers took him in the first round despite everybody saying that he was going to measure poorly. No, he measured poorly and then he went late because that's what happens when you measure poorly and you're considered a kick returner on tape. So we try to avoid getting that revisionist history where we think things happened the way that they did and they didn't. But most of the time there's usually some kind of explanation, whether it be an injury or maybe the player was just not prepared for it. Sometimes they just don't win in that way. One of my favorite examples to use is Anquan Boldin. Anquan Boldin ran a 4.740, so he was considered a terrible athlete. But then he also ran poorly in every other metric. He didn't measure above average in anything other than his size. So he didn't come out as a good athlete at all. But he was still picked in the second round, and he still had a Hall of Fame career. But Anquan Boldin didn't win because he was fast. He didn't win because he was explosive. He didn't win because he was agile. He won because he was so good at using his frame to outbox everybody and run routes that only he was really able to run, and he could outmuscle any corner that tried to get their hands on him. Like there was just no way that you were going to beat him in a fight at the line. So it's more than just looking at the metrics. Sometimes guys just don't win that way. That's just not how they win in the NFL. What was another? I know I'm still using receivers, but those are just the easiest examples.
Well,
but,
no,
Keenan
I mean
Allen's another one.
When you talk about
Keenan Allen.
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
Yeah. Keenan Allen's another guy. He plays for the Chargers. Keenan Allen isn't that fast. I think he ran in like the 4.6 range. But Keenan Allen can run routes and maintain his exact speed almost whenever he makes his cuts without losing any speed at all. So maybe he's not the fastest, but he doesn't lose any speed when he's cutting. So that's an incredible talent, and it's extremely rare. So even though he didn't measure all that well, he still has that other trait that makes him special. So if you have a guy that doesn't measure well, you can't just write him off because maybe they went in a different way.
There's no question. And I think what you're saying is, you know, as we get more and more scientifically oriented into all of this stuff, the scary part is if we had it many years ago, Jerry Rice never would have made it to the NFL. No one would have even brought him to camp. Everson Walls would have never gotten a sniff. You know, and that's what happens because there are some people who overvalue this stuff, and then there are others who will be smart about it and just use it as a tool or as an additional piece of information because ultimately it's what you do on tape that really matters to a scout.
Exactly. If you don't have elite traits, then, or elite metrics anyway, then you have to have some kind of trait that makes you elite and makes you really win on the field. And scouts are better than anybody at doing that. That's why they get paid money to do this mm-hmm. stuff, to go out and actually look at players. And I'm assuming, of course, that they're actually good at their jobs. That's what they get paid to do. They get paid to go out and find out those guys that have the traits. But we still run the combine because those other traits, those are easy to measure, and we can do that in a controlled environment. But it's checking boxes, and the scouts are the ones that put all that stuff together.
Folks, it's Kent Platy. He does a great job. Kent, one more time, if people want to access your metrics and see some of these RAS scores for these players, where do they go? How do they do it?
Well, like you said, I'm at MathBomb on Twitter, and that's the easiest way to get a hold of me. I answer questions all day whenever anybody needs them. You can download the application currently from RelativeAthleticScores.com. There's a link on the landing page to get you the download for it. It's currently in Windows in beta, and hopefully will be in Apple by the end of the year.
Kent, we appreciate the time. Thank you so much, and maybe we'll catch up to you before the draft, all right?
Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Have a great one.
Hey, you too. That's Kent Platy. Does a great job with some of the metrics. Paul and I learned a lot because I dip into it a little bit more than Paul does, but I think we kind of learned how they put things together. And I think you were a little bit encouraged. I could tell you a little bit nervous going. You're like, is this guy just going to care about the numbers and not care about tape? Does he get how it all works? There seems to be an understanding that there's a balance here, and these things matter to an extent, and there are some red flags that are raised or green lights that are put on based on what you see here combined with what you see with them on the field.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's fun for discussion purposes.
Yeah.
It's great to talk about. It certainly is a good topic to debate and go back and forth about. You love to hear some of the names thrown around. Ultimately, I'll never forget my old school personnel guy, my guru who I lean on all the time. He said to me, you know, the great thing about the combine or the pro days is that those numbers are concrete. There's no judgment about how fast the guy ran. Those things can be quantified. Those are legit measurements. You can't fight over that with somebody and say, well, he didn't do that. No, he did. The numbers are there. That's the best thing about any of these analytic services, is that the numbers are concrete. Now, as my personnel guy also said to me, it becomes a very small percentage for guys who, unless you're a Sashi Brown who just got fired by the Browns, it becomes a very small portion if you're old school, and I suspect Dave Gettleman is going to follow more of George Young's philosophy based on everything he has said to me. It's a very small portion. It's more of a double-checking tool. If you see a guy and you love him, you went to his practices, you saw some games, you saw some tape, and you love a guy, you can kind of double-check what you thought you saw and look at the numbers and say, yeah, that kind of firms up what I think I see.
Yeah.
Or here's the other one. Here's the other way that the old school guys use it. If somebody comes in and gives you a piece of paper and says, hey, John, these numbers are really good. Oh, yeah. You know what? We didn't really think much of that guy.
Let's look at him.
Let's look again.
Right.
Exactly.
And I think a couple of the guys he mentioned, like Alan Lazard, who I actually watched at the Senior Bowl, and like Kent suggested, I was one of these guys that looked at him on the field and said, you know what, this guy doesn't look that fast. He looks like a possession receiver. But then all of a sudden you see him, he runs a great 40, he runs a great 3-cone, and you're like, well, maybe he's a better athlete than you thought. You know, you have a guy like Nick Chubb, who had a serious knee injury as a sophomore, and people thought he lost some explosive ability. Well, you know what? He had some of the best broad and vertical jumps at the combine. So you say, you know what? That knee is probably pretty good if he's testing out of, you know, off the charts here on vertical and broad jumps, because that measures mm-hmm. the explosiveness in your lower body. So, though, again, for specific players, it's more important. For a guy like Saquon Barkley, and we kind of talked about this yesterday, his RAS rating is great at 9.96. This is what we thought he was going to be. It confirmed what we already knew about him.
I think the newborns who were born this afternoon at every hospital around the country could tell you Saquon Barkley is really good.
And he's a heck of an athlete.
But I will say this, and again, I'm going back to what I was talking about a minute ago with the personnel guy. So what happens is, in that second situation where you give me a piece of paper that says, we really should double-check this guy. Well, you double-check that guy then, whether or not you go back to his school and you work him out again, or, and maybe it's and or, you go back and look at tape again. And if you still don't like it, then right. It doesn't matter what the metrics say. The metric is going in the garbage, and it's like, okay, we double-checked the guy, mm-hmm. we did a blink on that, and we still don't like the guy, we're not taking him.
And I think the metrics might also give you an idea, well, if we really believe in our coaching staff, and we give, let's say, Lorenzo Carter from Georgia, who is Tate, maybe doesn't make a lot of plays, do we think if we hand him to our linebackers coach, and he could teach him more the nuances of the game, can he take that athleticism and turn him into a better player? That's something that I think sometimes to a fault, and they go too much in that direction.
Yeah.
But I think that can tempt, especially coaches when they look at the tape. And they're going to say, man, this guy ran a 4.39, his three cones off the charts. If I can just coach this kid, I can turn him into greatness. And you know what? Sometimes you get into trouble doing stuff like that.
That exact example was given to me by my personnel guru, and he says, when a coach tells you that, slam the door in his face and tell him to get out.
Because that's when you get into trouble. No
you
question.
Don't
about
want
it.
To do that.
All right, we got four people on hold. It's your calls the rest of the way at 201-939-4513. I know it's a little bit complicated. Hope you guys learned a little bit. I know Paul and I did. Another way to analyze these things, you got the RAS scores from Kent. And, of course, I'm sure you guys and Paul, you've seen them too, the Spark ratings where they have like the spider web charts for each player.
Yes.
Those are pretty cool. And then that's another way that some teams
they look
rate
like
these
flowers.
Guys based on. They do.
Right? Budding flowers?
Yeah, and I retweeted one the other day, and we were told going in that Derwin James was going to test off the charts. He tested off the charts, and he solidified himself as probably a top 15 pick with that performance at the combine. Anyway, let's get to your calls at 201-939-4513. Tony in Washington, D.C. will lead us off. Hey, Tony, how are you?
Hey, gents. Thanks for taking my call.
Hey, thanks for calling in, Tony, and thanks for holding. What's up?
Yeah, you guys have been crushing it these last 2 weeks, but you guys always do a great job.
We appreciate that. Thank you.
So let me just put it all in context. First off, I agree with whatever decision Mr. Gettleman makes. I'm a Gettleman fan. And secondly, I do understand people's logic in taking Barkley or Nelson at two. It is logical.
No, Tony, I agree. It is logical. We 100% agree. There are good reasons to choose either one of those players. We're with you.
But like you guys said, the value isn't there. It makes no sense to draft a running back or a guard with the second overall pick in a draft that is heavy at running back and guard.
And Tony, and that's the thing. Like, if let's say you don't draft Quentin Nelson, but the Giants, by some miracle, and again, this might not happen. It's just an example. Let's say the Giants end up drafting Isaiah Wynn or Will Hernandez at 34. I don't think either guy will be there. Let's just say in this theoretical argument they are. How much worse is the team going to be because you have Will Hernandez instead of Quentin Nelson? Maybe what, 2-3% worse? That's why I wonder about it.
No, now you might say that the guard position might be 2-3% worse, but the team will be better because you're going to have the number two pick.
Exactly, because you get Hernandez plus whoever you pick it to. Exactly.
Exactly, but fans aren't understanding that. You get Rashad Penny or Nick Chubb at 34. You are in a better place than taking Saquon at two.
Yeah,
that's
exactly.
The reality of value.
Tony, you're 100% right, and I'll let you continue. I just want to kind of bounce up on and put an addition thing there. Would you rather have Bradley Chubb at two and Sony Michel at 34 or Saquon Barkley at two and then Harold Landry, let's say, at a Boston College at 34? I, for one, would rather have Bradley Chubb and Sony Michel. I think you're getting a better combination of players.
I think it depends on how you fill out the rest of them around them, and it also depends
sure
on how you work free agency before the draft. I don't think it's a slam dunk answer right now. I don't think you're right. I don't think you're wrong. I think it's still to be determined.
But I think Tony's point, though, is that you look at the depth at those positions, though, and you see where the bigger drop-off is from position group to position group, and that does influence you to a certain extent.
Only if you took the draft inside its own bubble. You can't do that.
Well,
you can't take the draft inside a bubble.
Well, you can when you get there. Obviously, once you get to April and free agency's done and you know what else you have, then you are in a bubble.
But we're not there yet.
And that's fair.
So I can't agree or disagree with you.
And a quick point on that, that's what makes the free agency so weird in the NFL.
Yeah.
It's because you have to go to free agency first and then go to the draft. So every team is trying to fill holes in the draft.
Wait a minute.
So that's just another discussion.
Do you want to do it in the reverse? Do you want to draft first? Is that what I'm getting at?
Absolutely. You draft first,
so do
then
I.
You can fill your holes with free agency.
I agree.
It makes sense.
Yep.
Because that's why teams reach so much in the draft, because they couldn't fill their holes in free agency.
Players will never go for that.
Need.
The players and the agents would never go for that.
Every other sport has the draft first.
Understood.
You're right. You're absolutely right. But and you guys have explained what value is, but the fans, they are just so in love with Saquon Barkley. I don't get it. But you guys have explained this. But, yes, Bradley Chubb, once you get past Bradley Chubb, the pass rushers nosedive. Everyone has said that. But, anyway, here's my second point, my ultimate point. And you guys are pretty, for the most part, on board with this. In my opinion, there are only three players in this draft that we should take at two. Their names are Josh Rosen, Sam Darnold, and Bradley Chubb. Now, there has been a lot of smoke and a lot of overthinking about this, and I am not convinced that we're going to overthink ourselves out of this second pick. If I had to say it, I think we're going to get a quarterback. I mean, it's just lining up for that too well. To get a running back at two, it just doesn't make any sense. So, I mean, am I missing something here? I mean,
well, Tony, look, I don't think you would ever say that it's a foolish pick to pick the player you think is the best player in the draft. I will not be upset if they take Barkley. I will not be upset even if they take Nelson, because they're so good. But generally,
agreed.
I'm with you. If you want to combine positional value with the abilities of the players, I think you're on the right track. Tony, thanks for the call. We appreciate it.
To piggyback off of what he just said, and we've discussed this, and I do believe that Chubb is in the mix for Giants at two, and I do see the logic behind it. But
sure.
I will also tell you, I got a lot of vibe out of Indianapolis, and also other personnel people around the league who I've talked to who have said to me, Chubb is not, while he is the best by far, edge pass rushing defensive end in this draft, and the drop-off is steep. In most other drafts, he is not a top-five player because he is not a blue-chip, decade all-pro, guaranteed stud.
He is not in the same class as Myles Garrett was.
He is not.
Or Jadeveon Clowney when he got picked.
He is not.
And I've heard the same thing.
He's not Watt.
Well, no, but J.J. Watt was also picked 12 or 13. I'm talking about pre-draft analysis of high pass rushers that were taken. He's not in the Khalil Mack class. He's not with those other guys.
Yeah.
I would put him more in the Joey Bosa area, who was not considered a top overall pick. He was more considered in the 5 to 10 area. And remember, people were very surprised when Bosa went, I think, third to the Chargers that year, if I remember right.
I think he went
third. But that's kind of more the area that I've seen him talked about.
But that, and to Tony out there, I know you're still listening, that would be the additional piece of trepidation that you would have to swallow if you decided to go with the football 101 wisdom about taking the best guy in the defensive front seven with that pick. The philosophy is, okay, well, Chubb is that guy. But if you strictly look at him in a bubble, he is not.
Right.
He is not, compared to past drafts, a number two overall pick.
Right. Or if you grade.
So are you reaching?
Or if you grade the players, let's say if you're going on your traditional 8-point scouting scale, Barkley's a 7-7, Trump might only be a 6-9 or 7-1. You know what I mean?
I'm just throwing out.
I'm just throwing out an example. He would not be as highly rated in terms of as good at his position as Barkley or Nelson are at that.
And that's the point, John.
Correct.
Barkley is graded much higher as a running back than Chubb is as a potential superstar defensive end. That's not even in question.
And that's why, for me, folks, that's why I don't know what I would do yet. I know everyone thinks that I do, and I'm anti-Saquon, all this stuff. It's not true. To me, I see good reasons to go three or four different directions here. I really do. And I'm not sure where I fall yet. And that's, I think, part of the fun. 201-939-4513. And that's why I think trading down is still a good option as well. Travis in Queens is up next. Hi, Travis.
Hey, fellas. How you guys doing?
Travis, just don't say the same stuff you said yesterday. You got to bring something new to the table or I'm going to hang up on you. I'm just warning you.
Right.
I'm being straight up.
All right. Nah, it's cool. So look, right? Here's why I say you go running back, right? No, not even running back. Let's say the value, right?
Mm-hmm.
And here's why I disagree with you guys. It's because you guys is coming into the argument being biased. Here's how. you say quarterback, right? The shelf life for a quarterback is 10 years, right?
Probably more than that. Tom Brady's 40, okay. Eli Manning's 37, so probably more like 12 so to 15 like 14, years.
I just want to know, Travis, why you're putting me in this argument, because I'm not taking a quarterback under any circumstances.
No. So you definitely not, Doc. I know you're not, but you did agree with that statement that the quarterback shelf life, far as just on a number basis, is that's what it is. Right?
If you believe he is a franchise quarterback, okay. Then chances are your, quote, franchise guy is going to be here at least a decade. He's going to probably go through three contracts. Probably.
And there's nothing
wrong with saying that. That's usually the case.
Right. And now that's my point. That's my point at why you would take Barkley, is that you told me yesterday, you said a running back, 5 to 6 shelf life, right?
But at the number,
you said 8?
I would say somewhere prime years for a running back, I would say 6 to 7 seasons, maybe 8 at the high end,
You know what they say, the cliff at 30 is very steep. That's the usual theory in the NFL.
And now look, there are guys like LeSean McCoy that have maintained his elite ability, and he's been in the league, 9, 10 years already? It happens, but it's rare.
Right. Frank Gore.
So now, you take that average far as 9 to 10 years with a running back, half of that, I guarantee you, is Hall of Fame numbers we're talking about. So that's at number two. That's the whole point at getting. I'm not saying we go running back just because we need a running back. No, based on the performance of his tape and the combine he did, and we just got the information that you had the guy on earlier that told us his number is around a 9, around Adrian Peterson. The value is there. Listen, in my honest opinion, if the value is there at quarterback far as graded 9 and a quarterback, and then it would be tough. But to clean it all up, right, and I think you alluded to it a few days ago, Dot. You said that trading down, right, is like the worst-case scenario, which it is. You know, for the Giants.
Best case for players.
No, Travis, I don't know if you're talking too fast or you're not listening. My theory on this is very simple. Trade down and get a boatload of picks. If you can't get your price, I'm probably leaning towards Barkley. My third choice is probably leaning towards Chubb. And my fourth choice is probably leaning toward Nelson. I've made it very clear and very simple. And that's how I'm standing today. I reserve the right to change my mind, but that's how I stand.
So, John, let me ask you this then, right?
Yes, sir.
If you're the Cowboys, right, you're Jerry Jones, do you pick up Ezekiel Elliott option come the year after this one?
Well, I mean, Ezekiel Elliott's only been in the league for 2 years. They have him under contract for 2 more years, then they have the fifth-year option.
So it's 4 years. I thought it was three.
It's 4 and then the fifth-year option. And then, Travis, I think it's an interesting point, actually. And I think it's very tough. Look at the situation the Steelers are in with Le'Veon Bell.
Right. It is tough.
And when you get into a very tough situation with a running back, look, no one's been better than Le'Veon Bell. The guy's a monster. And if Saquon Barkley is 4/5 of the player Le'Veon Bell is, it's a very good pick, okay? Now, do you want to give your running back, after he's played 4 or 5 years in this league and has a lot of tread off the tire, do you want to give him a big second contract? And I think for all running backs, how many big second contracts have we seen in this league to running backs except for Adrian Peterson? And by the way, I think the Vikings, if you ask them and gave them some truth serum, they'd want that contract back. So I think that's a very difficult situation when you get into that second contract area with running backs, as you mentioned at the top of the call, just because of the nature of the position.
Right, but if Barkley turns out to be a Hall of Famer running back for the Giants, don't you think that was a great pick?
If he turns out to be a Hall of Famer, yeah, but there's no guarantee he's going to be a Hall of Famer.
Oh, no. Can I ask one more question about the
free agency? You know what, Travis? I'm going to say one thing before you get to your final comment. The guy's only a great pick if he helps the Giants win a Super Bowl. I don't care if he goes to the Hall of Fame. If they don't win another Super Bowl during his time here, it wasn't a great pick.
Well, that's not fair.
That's
nah, I kind of
because if you could have picked somebody else who would have helped you win a trophy, everybody would take that trophy more than a guy or a Hall of Famer.
Yeah, but you don't win a trophy because of one guy.
I'm not saying that. Yeah. I'm not saying that. But the decision process that gets you to that guy, That needs to be right. That's what I'm saying. That's fair.
But yesterday, that's why I brought up the Stanton situation. As far as they want to win, they want a trophy. But anyway, my question about free agency, right? They just cut Allen Robinson. I heard you say that the Giants dot is gonna like you believe that they're gonna pick up a wide receiver. Do you think he might be in our ballpark or no?
Thanks
for the call, guys. I love you.
Thank you.
Hey, Travis, great stuff. Great debate, and thank you for calling.
Better call today.
And I thought you made some really good points today. I really do. I think Allen Robinson is going to be one of the higher. Now with Landry franchise, he might be the top wide receiver on the market.
Yeah, I don't see his price range being anywhere in the Giants' ballpark.
Especially as long as Brandon Marshall is under contract, and you have Sterling Shepard, and you have Odell Beckham Jr. No, you don't have room for Allen Robinson.
Sterling Shepard just got married.
I know.
I saw that on the Giants social site on Giants.com.
And it's funny. If you guys listen, I did a radio interview with
him
at the end of last season. And he was, let me put it this way, he was lamenting the amount of planning that was required for said wedding.
It could be more difficult than a playbook.
And I think it is. And mm-hmm. My wife's into that sort of thing, so she looked at all the pictures on people.com and everything, and she marveled at the grandeur of it all, and I will leave it at that. Then again, he's also marrying a model who frankly probably I'm not sure who she works for, so I don't want to say – I'm not sure if she's Victoria's Secret. She might be a swimsuit. I'm not sure. One or the other. So frankly, with him on his rookie deal, it's almost like a Tom Brady Giselle situation here where she probably took care of a lot of that. Let me just leave it at that. Which isn't a bad thing, by the way.
And Sterling –
congratulations.
And absolutely, big thumbs up for you. And if you want to give the Giants a hometown discount on your second contract, feel free to do so since she's making so much money.
And by the way, a couple pictures. You saw Odell was there. Roger Lewis was there. It looked like they're having a lot of good time and a lot of
fun.
Was
Odell dancing?
I did not see any dancing. I saw them in I think Odell was one of the groomsmen based on the photo that I saw.
Oh, okay.
So it looked like that they
Well, you know nice Eli was dancing, that's for sure.
But bottom line, it looks like they had a lot of fun. Congratulations. They looked very, very happy.
Excellent.
Sterling is really one of the better people that
nice
has come
guy.
Through this building.
Really good guy.
Tremendous guy. He's phenomenal. And all the best. And I'm sure they're off to their honeymoon where they're going to have a ton of fun. All right, let's go to Marco in Connecticut. He's up next. Hi, Marco.
Hey, guys. How are you?
What's up,
buddy?
Great job this weekend. I listened to the shows. That you guys did a great job as always.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I couldn't help to notice, and I say this kind of tongue-in-cheek, but, Paul, you almost it's so funny sometimes to watch because you look visibly upset anytime some of the guests mentioned that the Giants that they thought the Giants could take a quarterback. You just – the tone on your face would change immediately.
And, Marco, even better, when the two guests, and I think it was Rick Saratella and Tony Pauline – thought the Giants shouldn't take a quarterback, his smile gets so wide, and he starts slamming his fist, and he's like, see, you agree with me. That means I'm right. I'm Paul DeTino.
We do occasionally have some very fine guests on the program.
I love you, Paul. You're the best.
All right. I'm not factoring in any trading back with what I think – or what I want to talk to you guys about, what I think the team will do. Because I think if they trade back, I mean, it's hard to predict right now. So I'm just going to say that they're staying at two. My conundrum here is that you have the most important position on a team is the quarterback. And then truly best player available is also considered.
Sure.
And then we have obviously the best value at number two. But I'm not going to get too caught up that Dave Gettleman says you should be drafting a future Hall of Famer at number two. However, that sticks kind of in my mind, and I think Barkley and Nelson fit that criteria really well.
I agree.
But Barkley and Nelson don't line up with some of the other areas. I mean, Barkley just continues. I mean, everything you hear about him just continues to get better and better and better. And for me, it's just like, I don't know. I mean, if you want to say best player available, future Hall of Famer, yeah, why not?
And Marco, I want to take it a step further, too. And you know me, I'm probably the most pro-quarterback person of all the hosts that we have on the show. Me and Jeff are. If you don't believe in your heart of hearts that one of these quarterbacks has a chance or has a reasonable chance to be a Hall of Fame quarterback, you shouldn't pick him.
Well, Let me say something about that, John. After watching them and kind of just thinking what I have, I watched college football a little bit. I came away from the weekend saying, the guy that I think is going to be great, oh, I don't know if he's going to be great, but I'm so intrigued by him, is Josh Allen. But I would tell you, if I was the GM at number two, I don't know if I would have the guts to draft him. Now, here's my issue, though. And this is, I love Eli. And it has nothing to do with Eli. I hope Eli starts every game next year and in 2 years. And it has nothing to do with Davis Webb. It's just about time, position, and value. You have an opportunity to increase the value at the best position on your team. So I look at what the Eagles had last year. I look at the Patriots of the past. I've even gone back, and Paul, we could jump in. The Packers of like the late 90s were loaded with quarterbacks. And if you listen to a lot of these GMs, they always say, once you're up there, draft a quarterback. Because although they might say that these guys are not franchise-changing quarterbacks, but really, what does anyone really know? Like, and people thought Jared Goff was a bust after getting drafted number one last year.
Yeah, but they did.
Marco, I gotta help you out, Mark. You asked me to jump in, so I'm gonna do it. You know, the college quarterbacks coming out, they're a different breed now. They're video game quarterbacks. They're nothing like the quarterbacks you're talking about from the last 20 years, who were pocket passers, play action passers, operating out of over center. Nowadays, most of them are spread guys. They're shotgun guys. They're first read guys. Quarterbacks in general, coming out now, are a different type. They're a video game quarterback. Different deal. Doesn't apply.
So this is a different conversation. Isn't there more of a responsibility on coaching then? Look at Sean McVay.
Yeah, but how are you going to do that?
Look at Doug Peterson.
How are you going to do that? The CBA destroys your ability to coach some of these guys up like you need to.
No, but I just gave you two examples of two young coaches, two first-time young coaches that took these young quarterbacks and had success with them.
Wentz played out of a pro-style system at North Dakota State. I scouted him. I know he did. He was ready. He was my first pick in that draft. I said it to everybody. He's going to be the best quarterback.
I agree with you on that, by the way.
Marco, you can't make generalizations here because you're going to get bombed out of the water.
No, but Paul Rosen played in just as pro of a system as Wentz did.
I understand but I got medical issues with him.
And that's fair.
What is the generalization? What I've said is you have an opportunity to increase value. So it has nothing to do with Davis Webb. If you draft, say, a Josh Allen at number two, then you're bringing him in and you're maximizing that position where it will not bust out.
Not necessarily, Marco, because even Josh Allen, who I happen to like the best of the quarterbacks, I think he's got the most long-term pro potential
and the highest ceiling. And he also did pro stuff at Wyoming.
He did. So I do like Josh Allen the best of all these QBs. So I'm with you on that. However, even he has question marks, whether it's his accuracy, which I think can get better, whether he did have something with his shoulder years ago, although he still rifles passes better than anybody in the country at the college level.
I wouldn't worry about his heart.
Okay. Well, I don't think it's going to be a problem short term, but I do wonder 7, 8, 9 years down the road if there's going to be any after effects with that. So even he, this is why I like him, but I'm not touching him with a 50,000-foot pole.
I guess that's your opinion then, Paul. Because it's like, for me, I would like to say if you're matching up risk, Allen and Davis Webb, you're telling me that take Davis Webb out of the building. I know we know him character wise. Josh Allen character wise seems like a good guy. He said he would back up Eli Manning for 3 years. I mean, so I'm talking skill level and where they're coming from. You're telling me that there's more of a risk with Josh Allen than there would potentially be if Davis Webb was a rookie coming out?
If you look at the entire package today, when you're talking about Josh Allen coming out today compared to a Davis Webb who has been here in a year, I think, because you have to look at the whole package. You can't just isolate it with what the guy's done on the field. In today's NFL, the personality matters, the leadership skills matter, the intangibles are huge. If I could get you on the phone with Dave Gettleman right now, he would tell you that was the whole point of going to the combine.
Thank you, Marco. We got to run, man. We only got 2 minutes.
All right, the whole point of Dave Gettleman's combine visits was to find out about medical and to find out about these guys' football mentality,
yeah, but
their personality, their interviews, their leadership skills. And we know what Davis Webb is already in those categories.
But what if they feel the same way about Josh Allen when they talk to him?
Well, then they're entitled to feel that way.
Right.
They're entitled to feel that way. But Marco is putting different parameters on this equation, and you can't. You can't. You can't. If you're going to tell me who is the bigger risk right now Josh Allen is the bigger risk. And it's not just because physically, if you put the two guys in a room, one guy can do this and one guy can do this. You can't do that.
So, wait, Paul, you honestly believe...
The skill set is not in a bubble.
You honestly believe that Davis Webb has the better chance of being an all-pro quarterback than any of the four people we have in this draft this year?
Right now, today, yes.
Oh, wow. Okay. We have to disagree on that.
That's fine.
We got two more calls. We got to do real
I'll
quick,
say this.
Guys. So
I guarantee you he'll be good enough, even if he doesn't make... Look, Phil Simms only made a couple of Pro Bowls, too.
No, I understand.
He'll be good enough. I've equated him to Kerry Collins. Kerry Collins got the Giants to a Super Bowl. That's where the bar is. He's got to be good enough.
I just
doesn't have to be an all-pro.
I just don't know what's happened between last year and this year that's elevated him from a third-round pick to a first-round pick.
He was a number two on a lot of personnel boards, I was told.
He didn't. Well, apparently not the 32 teams that selected in the second round.
Well, you know better than that, John.
Well, but
make
you know what I mean.
A crazy
though.
Statement like that, because just because a guy's value is second round,
times.
Just because a guy's value is second round doesn't mean you have to take him there.
Quarterbacks get overdrafted; they don't get underdrafted.
Never mind. We got one more.
We got two more. We got
all right.
Go. Real quick,
go.
Joe in Pennsylvania, you're up next.
Hey, I can't pass this one up there. I start with a joke there. At least we don't have to worry about Sterling taking off on bye week there, cacahoons, saying I'm going with the boys. Now all we have to do is get Becca married.
Okay.
All right, Joe, what's your
good way to
point?
Start the call?
So going on there, I know we're quick again. I just have to say we're in a great position. I love it. I hear in the Browns, you know, are looking at Barkley, and in some ways I hope they take him. And the only one I have to disagree with if we're up there, if we do take Allen, because I do hear he has the most potential, and we're not going to decide on that. But was Gettleman there when we took Snead and Eli? Was he the scout then?
Well, he was in pro personnel. He wasn't doing the college draft, but a lot of times, Ernie, of course, he would have him do a double check of some of the guys that the team was going to pick.
But that was all Ernie. Ernie was the guy who was headstrong. He had to get Eli Manning against many opinions that were different in this building, including Wellington Maris.
Well, what I want to say here, too, maybe the best thing for us is if the Browns would take Barkley like you, Paul, wouldn't you see that phone calling off the hook, you know what I mean, what we possibly could get. You were talking about not trading down with the Bills. I hear questions going to New England that they might decide to jump up for a quarterback. They have them tackles and everything. They can give us players.
No,
but
no.
They're number twos in one. And Gettleman makes the picks. Hey, he makes. So we are in a great position there. That's all I'm saying there. And maybe the best thing it would be for the Browns to take Barkley, you know. That's all I want to say. Thank you.
All right,
hey, appreciate
Joe.
The call, Joe.
You could make that case, because if the Browns take Barkley, the Giants' phone is going to start just ringing off the hook, and it's going to turn red like the commissioner's phone in Gotham City. When the bat phone used to glow red,
I know
that's what's going to happen.
See, now, I was thinking the other way, though. You know, if people think that highly of Barkley, wouldn't the phone ring more if he's left?
No, because there are too many teams that are desperate for a QB as opposed to being desperate for a running back.
But there's still three quarterbacks there.
Yeah, but
what if they like one of the other three?
Chances are, most of these teams who are desperate for quarterback, they've got one guy who they're really, really wanting more than the others. Chances are.
Yeah, but you're assuming that's the guy the Browns take.
Don't know.
But that's what I'm saying.
There's
everyone loves Barkley. Honestly, I think the phone's going to be ringing off the hook no matter who the Browns pick.
You're right.
I don't think it's going to matter, to be quite honest with you.
It is going to ring a lot.
Right.
Which is why I want to milk them for them picks, baby!
You're okay?
I'm good.
All right, final call of the show, and then we got to go eat some lunch. Let's go to Dan in Delaware. He's our final caller. Oh, and a free agency question. Good, Dan. This is a good preview of what the rest of the week of shows is going to be as we switch focus to free agency. Go ahead.
No problem. Yeah, I had a quick draft comment. Also,
that's okay. Go ahead.
John, you and I are in a complete lockstep when it comes to the quarterbacks in round one. In terms of you know, if we like a guy, we got to take him. I'm actually the one that sent you that tweet about the you know, if you draft a quarterback in the first five picks versus all the other, and how further down the chances of success it goes. So I just believe philosophically, if we like a guy, your likelihood of success is getting the quarterback early. So I just think that way. You know, Paul, I hear what you're saying about Webb. You know, you believe in him, but for Webb to find long-term success, he statistically would have to be an outlier or an anomaly.
That's okay.
I don't know that passing on a potential top five quarterback is worth the risk of putting all the eggs in the Webb basket, but that's all personal preference.
Yeah, and
you know,
Dan, and Dan, real quick, I just want to give, and I thought it was a great tweet, and I've actually printed it out. I've handed it to a couple people in the building. Somebody out in Denver, Andrew Mason, put together a list of when quarterbacks were selected. This is for the fans out there. And of this is since 1990, of quarterbacks picked numbers 1 through 5 in the draft, 58% of those players were Pro Bowl caliber, and the average years as the primary starter was 6.3. For the rest of the first round, picks 6 through 32, just 19% of those players selected made it to the Pro Bowl. The second round was 12%. The third round was 15%. So once you get past that top five, you're looking at anywhere between a 1 in 5 to 1 in 8 chance, or 1 in 9 chance for your quarterback selected to be a Pro Bowl caliber quarterback.
Yeah, it depreciates greatly according to that those numbers. And there's also Super Bowl numbers in there too, John, if you look at the second column too.
Right.
You know, so like that's just it's just philosophical. And the free agent question that I wanted to ask was we keep getting linked to Norwell, and I agree he is a great guard, and I know we got the Gettleman connection and everything. Looking at the combine and seeing what a lot of these analysts and experts and gurus say about the offensive line class this year, the way I'm interpreting it, it seems like the guards are more highly sought out or highly regarded than the tackles.
Yes,
and
agreed.
So what I wanted to ask was, since we're linked to Norwell, would it not make more sense to go after a guy like a Solder if he's available, and maybe draft the guards since they look like they're more pro-ready, plug-and-play kind of guys, maybe at the top of round two or trading back in around one
at
the end.
Dan,
something like that.
We're back to the trick. Do you pick the better player at the less valued position, or do you pick the player that's not as good at the highly valued position? We're back to the same conversation again.
How about we just get economically...
Well, John, I look at quarterbacks differently. I think quarterbacks are the exception to the every...
Well, no.
Everything,
Dan, no, I wasn't talking about quarterbacks. I was talking about tackle versus guard. Offensive tackles are valued more.
Exactly.
Solder's not as good of a player as Norwell. He's older,
but
it's harder to find the tackle.
So how about
I'm asking your opinion on it, because
it's hard.
It's a tough choice. I mean, it's like, can we get a tackle in this draft? Like, the one guy that I seem to like, is
McGlinchey.
Miller from UCLA. He seems like, just looking at him at the combine, he just looks like it to me. But I don't know. I don't know what any of these guys are going to end up being. And we know Solder is like a good to above average starting left tackle, and I'm sure the cost will be ridiculous, but could we get a better quality guard that could start day one in round two or to end the round one and know we have the left tackle spot locked down?
Why not be economically
reasonable,
sign Cameron Fleming, and then draft Will Hernandez in the second round?
Get
a guard and get a tackle, you're very happy.
I
know, he's not going to be there.
I know. I'm sorry.
We kept hearing he's going to sneak into the bottom of the first. I know.
I've heard top 25 now for him. Even.
Oh, my goodness.
You know, and that's the trick. I mean, like you said, Nate Solder's an above-average tackle. He's never made a Pro Bowl. And and with all these injuries you have, it's not that hard to make a Pro Bowl these days. He's never made one.
I know.
Now, some of that might have to do with the fact that the Patriots are always playing deep in the playoffs, so he's never one of the reserves that can actually
go and
play in the game.
No question.
But, you know, it's a tough situation. But, you know, we're going to jump into that more over the next few days.
By the way,
we're going to get into free agency.
We never told people that Taggy Day is today. It's now officially
right.
over. The transition and franchise tags have to be slapped on by 4 o'clock today, or you cannot do it.
Did the Panthers do anything?
I did not see anything today, but I thought they were taking Gano.
Right. I was asking you if they actually tagged him or not.
Well, let's see. Let's see if anything has come up in the last hour, because that was the understanding. Let's see here. Apparently, it is not at the moment, but it is rumored that they are trying to get a long-term deal with him. So says the gentleman from the Observer.
Lady,
with Gano.
Actually. Lady.
The lady, yes, you're right. With the Observer, says they're trying to get the deal done before tagging him at 4 o'clock today. But it says they will likely tag him if it doesn't work out.
So they still have 2.5 hours then?
They have 2.5 hours.
Okay. And DeMarcus Lawrence was given the tag by the Cowboys. Not a surprise.
And he signed it.
Maybe a surprise that he signed it right away. So he'll be back with the Cowboys. No holdout for him. He'll be back next year. Heck, who doesn't want $16.8 million guaranteed for injury? That's not a bad deal. So that's what DeMarcus Lawrence got. And then Le'Veon Bell, it looks like he's going to get franchised at some point today. I don't think that's happened officially yet.
Not yet.
But that is expected to happen as well. And we'll see if any other teams, and the Rams, by the way, are rumored to be putting a tag on either Sammy Watkins, which I think would be crazy talk given his lack of production, or DeMarcus Joyner, which LaMarcus Joyner,
excuse me.
I think that's more realistic at
the it just
position.
Got done.
And LaMarcus Joyner's been the franchise. There you go. Thank you, Dan Salmo, for sticking with us late. Excellent calls. Great conversation today. I thought we got a lot of the different angles kind of out there. And Paul and I disagreed, but that's fine.
It's okay.
That's what we're supposed
to
do. That's what makes the show good.
It's not a problem.
Thanks for joining us. Just a heads up tomorrow, folks. Keep an eye on the schedule. Snow tomorrow. Good chance the office is going to be closed. We're not going to ask Salmon to plow the roads. We can all get in to do the show. So keep an eye on the schedule. Look at the Twitter account. We'll let you know if the show's on tomorrow or not. For Paul Dottino and Dan Salmon, I'm John Schmoke. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you maybe tomorrow, but definitely on Thursday on Giants.com. Have a good one, everyone.